This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for listening today. Donald Trump is responding to widespread concerns about his financial conflicts of interest. We've been talking about them on the show. He tweets that he's leaving his business in total, saying the presidency is a far more important task. Now, he doesn't say whether he's going to form a blind trust or whether his children will simply run the assets that he already knows he has, which wouldn't do anything about the conflict. Meanwhile, Trump has picked a Treasury Secretary nominee. Later this hour, we'll look at Steve Mnuchin, a former Goldman Sachs banker and Hollywood producer, who later ran a bank that foreclosed on tens of thousands of families after the housing collapse. Working class voters, are you listening? Now, Steve Mnuchin might not be the type of bank regulator that Trump voters had in mind when they were thinking about their jobs, their regions, their country. Mnuchin comes from the world of international finance. And in that way, the choice does make a kind of sense because many Trump voters might not have a sense that they are part of an international movement. But in truth, populist parties and nationalist politicians have been scoring successes not just here, but in places all over the world, like Germany, Poland, Greece, but also the Philippines, Egypt, Turkey, and of course, the UK. Elections are just around the corner in France and Austria, where right-wing populist parties are gunning for more power and polling well. Yasha Monk and Mark Blythe spend a lot of their time studying how and why nationalist populist movements are on the rise and why the United States is flirting with a type of politics that can threaten the very foundations of liberal democracy. Donald Trump's strategies aren't new, but they flourish in a country where belief in democracy itself is waning. Mark Blythe is Eastman Professor of Political Economy at the Watson Institute for International Affairs at Brown University. And Yasha Monk is a lecturer on government at Harvard University and a fellow in the Political Reform Program at New America. Yasha's been researching the norms that make a strong democracy, and he's found that they're weakening in the United States.
We argue that for a country to be consolidated, for us to have confidence that democracy is stable and secure there, three things should be true. An overwhelming majority of citizens should like democracy, give real importance to living in democracy. An overwhelming majority of citizens should reject authoritarian alternatives to democracy, like army rule. And there should be an absence of what we call anti-system parties and movements. Looking at the first one, how important is it to people to live in a democracy? Well, in the United States, people born in the 1930s and 1940s still have real attachment to democracy. Over two-thirds say that it's essential to them to live in a democracy, 10 out of 10. Once you get to younger people, to millennials born since 1980, that value drops very rapidly. You're at less than one-third who think it's really important to live in a democracy.
Mark, do those numbers that Yash is talking about sort of make sense when you look at the other countries around the world, Venezuela, Greece, other places where populist movements, usually on the right but maybe on the left, have gained traction and maybe destabilized a country?
You got to think about this in a longer term. So let's think about what happened to the war from 1945 to 1975. That trauma, which basically instantiated and made democracy a real value for people, led to a policy regime where governments everywhere targeted full employment. That was the one thing we needed. And there was a flaw in doing that, which is basically that once you have full employment for a sustained period of time, labor can move costlessly from job to job. Unions become very, very powerful, and wages have to inexorably increase right across the wage spectrum. The only way that businesses can deal with this is by pushing up prices, and then you get that classic 1970s wage price spiral. So by the time you get to the 1970s, it was a bit of what I call a debtor's paradise. And what I mean by that was you had sustained inflation. So think about all the baby boomers who took out big mortgages. Half of it was eaten away by inflation. And at the same time, corporate profits were low, inequality was low, unions were powerful. Then you had the Reagan and Thatcher revolutions and everything that followed from that. You had globalization of trade, integration of finance. And for the next 30 years, we decided that inflation was the number one problem. And when you target inflation for 30 years, something happens. Central banks around the world since the crisis have dumped 13 trillion euros into the global money supply. And there's no inflation anywhere. Labor cannot push up wages simply because if you try, we'll move your job abroad. And what that's meant is wage stagnation for the majority of the population across the OECD for the past 15 years in the context of a crushing recession whereby the top 20% of asset holders got everything bailed out and it was austerity for the rest, particularly in Europe. That has set a political cauldron up of creditors against debtors, very similar to what we've seen in the 1930s. And that's exactly what generates those types of authoritarian to hell with democracy reactions.
Yasha, the United States isn't Venezuela, right? Venezuela has gone progressively more authoritarian in the last 20 years. It's a mess. There are commonalities in the economy. There are commonalities in the politics that you've pointed out. But doesn't the U.S. have a much lower center of gravity, a much more ballast below it, that it's not necessarily going to teeter the way of Venezuela or Greece because of one election or because of bad wages? I want to believe that.
Look, the United States obviously has a deep democratic tradition. It has a very vibrant civil society. It has a constitution with strong checks and balances. But in the end, it's up to us to defend the Constitution. The Constitution cannot defend itself. And so we'll see over the next years when, as I fully expect it will, the Trump administration starts to undermine democratic norms and practice, to try and go against the neutrality of state institutions like the Internal Revenue Service or the Department of Justice. We'll see whether rank-and-file bureaucrats are willing to go along with that. We'll see whether moderate Republicans rebel against it or go right along with it. That's what the safety and stability of our liberal democracy will ultimately depend on.
Well, Yasha, what do we know about all of these sort of metrics of stable governments that you've described? Violating norms is something we're going to be experiencing. You've described it. What's the connection to racism here? What do we know about that?
We know something very simple, which is that these two explanations are not rival. Social psychology shows extremely clearly that when people are doing well economically, when they feel optimistic about the future, they become more racially tolerant. They become more willing to share a little bit of a pie. They are happy when other people are doing well, too. And once they start being worried about the economic future, once they have strong anxiety, they prioritize the in-group over the out-group very strongly. They become very jealous when other people are doing well. So this whole debate we've had over the last 2 or 3 weeks, you know, is it racism or is it economic anxiety, I think is really missing the larger point that these two things are fueling each other. And then I think it's also this very strong rebellion of the regions against the metropolitan center. The economic fate of rural Michigan and New York City has really diverged in an extreme way. And with social media and other things, people who are far away from the metropolitan center have become better able to organize and to have a voice. And we're now seeing their anger playing out in the political sphere in this very extreme way.
I just want to put one thing on top of that, which I think is very important to stress. And there's been an awful lot of strum and drang over this whole thing about whether it's race or whether it's economics. Let's think about what, when you diagnose things as racism, it allows you to do. It allows the center-left, those who have been in power, such as the New Democrats, New Labour, the SPD in Germany in the 1990s and 2000s, who built the current regime, who globalized production, who made people more insecure, whose policies led to a contraction of wages and a huge skewing of the income distribution. They were putatively left parties, but they didn't actually behave that way. They abandoned their core constituents and did a set of policies that benefited the top 20%. This is true everywhere. Now they're getting payback for this. And the narrative that it's all racism is completely exculpatory for these people because it allows the left to say, we didn't do anything wrong. It's not us. We're perfect. It must be those terrible people, those quote-unquote deplorables. And I think that's a deplorable argument.
So Mark, what's the way back from this then? And I say the way back, not saying that people's choices were wrong, that they shouldn't want populism. But what's the way back to a politics that can reorient the kinds of economics that we're talking about and reorient the politics of the top 20% without violating democratic norms, without calling out judges for being racist because of their birth, without attacking the First Amendment? What's the way back from this?
A very large part of it, at least for the left and the center parties, is to re-engage with their own base. The Democrats in this country ran a strategy for around 15 years, which was essentially Wall Street money plus identity politics equals win. That is now a failing strategy and is shown to be so. If you don't go back and actually re-engage with the 20 to 40% of the income distribution that you're meant to be there for, whose interests you're meant to represent, and actually argue for the things that are genuine concerns in their lives, then why do you exist as a party? Now, in terms of what happens on the right, that's an entirely different story. Some people are quite happy with the way things are going. Most of them, I think, will not be once they see the results, and we'll see what happens there. But ultimately, it's about re-engaging, and that's where the populists really do have a story to tell. It's all fine and well to be concerned about global norms and global regimes, the WTO for trade, the IMF for this, independent central banks. But what you're doing is you're externalizing your responsibilities to others who don't have to care. And the electoral price that you pay, you're shielded against because you don't have any skin in the game. So you can do bad policy after bad policy and you keep getting re-elected and promoted to your next position of authority. That's a bad system. The populace are right to call it out, and the democratic forces have to recognise that, re-engage and reinvigorate the democratic institutions. They've got to get people to believe in the project. They can't assume that they do.
Yasha Monk, your final thoughts.
Mark is absolutely right about a lot of these things. I would add that identity is also an important part of this. And what we have to do is to realize the amount of discrimination that does go on, realize how imperfect our societies are in terms of treating ethnic and religious minorities decently, but we also have to avoid a politics that is just organized around identity lines on the left as well as the right. We need to figure out how we can make people see the commonalities, work for a more just society, but not in a way that divides us from each other. I'm very worried that the main dividing line of our politics is now becoming about race and identity, and that is just going to make the fights between different parties more and more vicious. It's just going to make us see political competitors as enemies more and more, and that is a real concern I have for how things are going to play out in the United States over the next 10, 20 years.
Yasha Monk, thank you.
Thank you.
Yasha Monk is a lecturer on government at Harvard University. Mark Blythe, thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Blythe is at Brown University.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.